Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 47, Octavius Octavian. Julius Caesar was dead. Upon hearing the news, the people of Rome shut themselves up in their homes. After years of civil war, peace had finally come to the turbulent capital. But now, Caesar's final settlement turned out to be little more than the eye of the hurricane. The people implicitly understood that the liberator's vision of a restored republic would mean little more than the return of violent chaos. So they did not rush to embrace Cassius. They did not cheer for Brutus. They simply turned their backs, resigning themselves to what was clearly this generation's lot in life, pain, sacrifice, and bloodshed. And not only did the people of Rome get it exactly right, that Caesar's murder would lead to renewed civil strife, but the liberators got it exactly wrong. Far from restoring the old republican order, the assassination of Julius Caesar hastened its demise. The liberators made three basic intertwined mistakes. First and foremost, they had no plan for what to do after Caesar was dead. In a classic display of not thinking through the consequences of one's actions, they were so obsessed with removing the dictator that they did not think about who would fill the power vacuum when he was gone. It seems not to have occurred to them to make arrangements for someone, anyone, to assume executive power once the man who had consolidated nearly all executive power into his hands was gone. It was a palace coup without a replacement king waiting in the wings. And this exposed their second great mistake, focusing all their attention on Caesar. In the moments after the assassination, Mark Antony fled from Pompey's theater, disguised himself as a slave, and fled the city, convinced that he would be a target of assassination himself. When you depose a ruler, it's just common sense to purge his supporters at the same time. Otherwise, they come back and undo everything you were trying to accomplish by deposing the ruler in the first place. Which is, of course, exactly what Antony did a few days later when he realized no one was out to get him. As consul for that year, an unharmed Mark Antony had every legitimate reason to step into the power vacuum left by Caesar's death. If the liberators thought they were going to restore the republic by letting Mark Antony anywhere near power, they were mistaken, bordering on delusional. As Cicero later said, the Ides of March was a fine deed, but half done. Letting Antony live was incredibly short-sighted. Finally, the assassins completely miscalculated the people's reaction to the death of Caesar. The liberators, who were all high-born senators, seemed to have been living in something of a bubble. They saw Caesar as a dangerous tyrant. Removing him from power was a self-evident good. But the lower and middle classes saw Caesar not as a dangerous tyrant, but as a powerful advocate of their interests, a man who had always gone to bat for them against the oligarchy of wealthy princes who never gave them the time of day, who gobbled up their land, hoarded the profits of empire, and forced them to live wretched lives in urban slums. If the liberators thought murdering Caesar was going to make them heroes to the people, they understood nothing about how the average Roman lived. They would pay a price for their blindness. In just a matter of days, these men who thought themselves heroes, who believed they had just delivered Rome from one of history's greatest monsters, would find themselves on the run, their homes ransacked, and their heads called for by the enraged masses of Rome. Perplexed, and perhaps a bit offended that the liberators had not thought him worthy of assassination, Mark Antony returned to Rome a few days after the Ides of March, quietly reassuming the consulship which, with Caesar now gone, was once again the highest office in the land. The first order of business was to open Caesar's will and find out how the late dictator planned to allocate his power and fortune. Calpurnia had retrieved the documents from their deposit box at the Temple of the Vestas and turned them over to Antony as soon as he was back in the city. What Antony read disheartened him. Despite his years of service and loyalty, he was accorded no official place among Caesar's heirs. Instead, incredibly, Caesar left three-quarters of his fortune to his practically unknown and certainly untested 19-year-old great-nephew, Gaius Octavius. Even more incredibly, Caesar stipulated in the will that he was adopting Octavius posthumously. Just like that, Antony was faced with a dangerous rival for power. He had assumed that with their old general dead, the loyalty of Caesar's legions would naturally pass to his chief lieutenant. But now, suddenly, there was a son of Caesar. Would the legions rally to this upstart, or would they stick with the man who had shared their barracks and mess tents through all these long years of war and hardship? It was not a rhetorical question. Across the empire, the legions who had pledged themselves personally to Caesar would now be faced with a choice, the son or the best friend. Gaius Octavius, the man who would become Caesar Augustus, was born during the consulship of Cicero in 63 BC. He was the son of an up-and-coming novus homo, also named Gaius Octavius, who had been recognized as a rising star and married to Julius Caesar's niece Attia. However, when young Gaius was only 5, his father had died, and his mother remarried a cautious politician named Lucius Marcius Philippus. His early years were spent primarily in the care of his grandmother, Caesar's sister Julia, who oversaw his education until she died in 51 BC. There did not seem to be anything particularly remarkable about the boy, certainly nothing to indicate that in a few years he would become, I don't know, the master of the known world. In fact, he seemed to lack all the qualities that mark young Roman boys for greatness. He was fragile, prone to sickness, not particularly strong, and forever hovered over by an overprotective mother. But he was an able student, showed promise in oratory, and most critically, seemed to attract the right kind of friends. It was at school, for example, that he met Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa, the low-born son of a nobody, who was immediately drawn to the thoughtful, if frail, young aristocrat. Agrippa was everything that Octavius was not, a physically gifted natural athlete who impressed every old soldier he ever came across. As much as Caesar was eventually struck by the clever mind and solid character of his young nephew, he was never under any illusions about the boy's physical prowess. But in the friends Octavius surrounded himself with, Agrippa in particular, Caesar felt comforted that the boy was in good hands. Indeed, throughout the coming civil wars, when Octavian is described as having won this or that battle, what historians really mean to say is that Agrippa won this or that battle for Octavian. The childhood friends conquered the empire together, Octavian handling the politics, Agrippa the armies. It was one of the most successful partnerships in history. Young Octavius did not come into regular contact with his famous uncle until Caesar returned triumphant from North Africa. He had been forbidden to join the campaign by his mother, who feared the boy would break under the stress of army life. But when Caesar emerged victorious from the civil war, Octavius found himself in the unique position of being related to the most powerful man in Rome. He was bombarded from all sides by people looking to use his special access to procure favors, appointments, and handouts. But at the time, he was basically just a kid and had no reason to think he had any pull whatsoever with his uncle, so what the heck were they bothering him for? Famously, though, Octavius finally mustered the gumption to approach Caesar and ask a favor. Agrippa's brother had been on the losing side of the North African War, but having already been pardoned by Caesar once before, he had no hope of clemency, as it was well known that Caesar's generosity was extended one time only. Getting caught on the wrong side a second time meant death. Caesar granted the request of his young nephew without hesitation, though, to the relief of both Octavius, who feared provoking the wrath of his uncle, and Agrippa, whose brother's life hung in the balance. That Octavius took such a personal risk for Agrippa cemented their bond forever and earned Octavius a well-deserved reputation for loyalty. Without a legitimate male heir, Caesar had his eye on Octavius, and when the Pompey brothers started trouble in Spain, he intended to place the young man on his general staff and test his military mettle. But as the legions were preparing to march from Rome, Octavius was felled by one of his frequent sicknesses and had to be left behind. Unfortunately for Octavius, his early career would be riddled by these untimely sicknesses. You know, the kind of sicknesses that keep you confined to a tent when you should be out on the battlefield. So, whether deserved or not, along with his reputation for loyalty, young Octavius will soon acquire a damaging reputation for cowardice as well. There is no indication that he was ever faking sick, but once too often the legions marched off and left him behind to mend from some new affliction. Eventually, people started to notice a pattern. But Octavius was determined to make it to Spain, so when he recovered, he set out with a small cadre of friends, Agrippa included, to join Caesar at the front. But if he hoped to get his first taste of battle, he was too late. By the time he reached Spain, the war was already over. But it was not a total loss. Caesar had Octavius stay with him in his tent, and when the legions packed up and headed back to Rome, Octavius spent most of the journey in his uncle's carriage, picking the brain and having his brain picked by the great general. And despite his late arrival, he earned the respect of Caesar for having set out on his journey before knowing the outcome of the war, unlike the endless stream of politicians who waited to find out who won before pouring out of Rome to find Caesar and pay their respects. Octavius, though, was eventually dislodged from his prime seat alongside Caesar, when Mark Antony joined the caravan in Gaul. Octavius found himself in the next carriage back, seated alongside Decimus Brutus, one of Marcus Brutus's cousins, and a longtime supporter of Caesar, who would soon join the Liberator conspiracy and then play a central role in the early stages of the post-Ides of March civil wars between the Senate, Octavius, and the man who had just taken Octavius's spot in Caesar's carriage, Mark Antony. At some point during the journey home from Spain, Caesar made up his mind about Octavius, and when they returned to Rome, one of the first things he did was rewrite his will, officially declaring that in the event of his death, Octavius was to be posthumously adopted and put in charge of the family and fortune of the Julii. As an ironic historical footnote, the will also stipulated that Octavius was dead or refused the inheritance, then everything should go to Marcus Brutus, the man Caesar had always loved and treated as his son. Et tu, Brute? To prepare Octavius for a life at the forefront of war, politics, and empire, Caesar introduced his new heir, not that anyone, Octavius included, knew that Caesar had rewritten his will at this point, to the life of an all-powerful official. The young man acted as a sort of administrative assistant, serving as an intermediary between the hordes of men who wanted 5 minutes, just 5 minutes, with Caesar, and the man himself, who did not physically have time for them all. Octavius learned quickly how politics really worked, what was important, what could be left for another day, who should be flattered, and who could safely be ignored. After this crash course in practical administration, Caesar arranged for Octavius to complete his education in Apollonia, where he would learn oratory from the Greek masters and soldiering from the Macedonian legions. Then, in a few months, when Rome launched its invasion of Parthia, Octavius would serve alongside Caesar and learn his final, most valuable lessons: how to run an army, how to win a war. But of course, Octavius would never learn those final lessons from his uncle. Word came from his mother in a letter dated March 15, 44 BC, that Caesar was dead. Even though she did not yet know the content of Caesar's will, simply by virtue of being a male relative of the murdered dictator, Attia knew that her son was in danger. She implored Octavius to return to Rome, but avoid getting entangled in the public fallout of the assassination. This request directly contradicted the advice Octavius received from his friends and mentors in Apollonia, who encouraged him to immediately take command of the 5 legions in Macedonia, march on Rome, and avenge his uncle. While making no commitment to a private life as his mother wished, Octavius rejected the notion that he could or should lead 25,000 men in an illegal invasion of Italy. He had never even witnessed a battle, let alone fought in one, and at this point, he had very real doubts about whether or not he was cut out to be a general. So he split the difference and decided to travel back to Italy with a small company of allies and figure out what his role would be in this new post-Caesar world. He arrived in Brundisium and carefully approached the legions that had been mustered there for the now-canceled Parthian campaign. He found himself well-received by the soldiers and in no immediate danger from the anti-Caesar faction. Apparently, back in Rome, Antony had delivered a funeral oration in the Forum while Caesar lay in state and had whipped the masses into an anti-liberator frenzy. He told them that Caesar had always held the people at the forefront of his mind, and that according to his recently opened will, the bulk of his property would be given to the citizens of Rome. Then he brought out Caesar's bloodstained toga and held it for all to see, pointing to each stab hole in the fabric and naming the assassin. Here, Cassius. Here, Brutus. The inflamed masses rioted, looting the shopping pavilions and building a massive funeral pyre for the body of Caesar. Then they turned on the liberators, who were forced to flee the city while the angry mobs overran their homes. Of course, Octavius soon learned that Antony's speech had been full of exaggerated showmanship. The bulk of the Caesar estate had not been left to the citizens of Rome. It had been left to him. Though the estate was not technically left to Gaius Octavius, it was instead left to Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, Caesar's posthumously adopted son. What role would Octavius have in the new post-Caesar world? How about one right smack dab in the middle of everything? His mother begged him to refuse the adoption and inheritance. She understood perfectly well what it meant to be Caesar's sole heir, what would be expected of him, and what enemies he would immediately earn. If he took Caesar's name, in all likelihood, he would share his uncle's fate. But weak and fragile Octavius revealed some of the steel lurking in his heart and rejected this advice. No, he would become Gaius Julius Caesar, avenge his late father, and guarantee the dictator's legacy. At this point, Octavius apparently dropped his old name altogether, and henceforth went by simply Gaius Julius Caesar, the name that would rouse the passion and loyalty of his newly inherited allies. His old name, Octavius, amended to Octavianus to denote that he had been adopted out of his biological family, was still officially attached to his identity, but in practice it disappeared. However, historians label the new Gaius Julius Caesar Octavian through this period simply to avoid confusing him with his dead uncle. So, just to recap, before the adoption, we call him Octavius. After the adoption, but before he wins the Civil War, we call him Octavian. After the triumph over Mark Antony, we call him Augustus, a title conferred on him by the Senate in 27 BC. His friends, however, called him Gaius, while everyone else called him Julius Caesar. Got that? Good. Octavian was hailed by Caesar's legions in Brundisium as their rightful new leader, much to the chagrin of Antony. But it was not just the name of Caesar that drew the legions to support Octavian so readily. Having run the assassins out of town, Antony's posture suddenly became conciliatory. He met with the Senate and appeared to be arranging a truce, amnesty for the liberators in exchange for the Senate's promise not to cancel any of Caesar's reforms or appointments. To the men of Caesar's legions, though, this was nothing less than a betrayal. They didn't care about avoiding a new civil war or the greater good of the state or Antony's personal ambition. They wanted revenge. Their honor demanded it. Antony's honor ought to have demanded it, too. To see him meeting with the Senate and talking compromise was an outrage that Octavian immediately capitalized on. The young Caesar made for the capital, and blowing up his mother's dream of a quiet, safe, private life for her son, set about publicly destabilizing the shaky truce in Rome. Even at this early stage of the game, it was obvious that Octavian's ambitions were lofty, and that he just maybe had the talent to pull it all off. But he was young and needed time to consolidate his position. He did not need any grand alliances leaving him isolated, the odd man out in what was shaping up to be a deadly game of political musical chairs. So he riled up Caesar's veterans, turning them against Antony and promising to do what the waffling consul would not, avenge Caesar's death. The campaign against Antony was designed to either alienate him from Caesar's old legions, and thus deny him his most important power base, or force him to abandon his possible alliance with the Senate in favor of a more radical position to mollify the troops. Antony, predictably, chose the latter. He knew he was nothing without the support of Caesar's legions. So he broke off talks with the Senate and embraced far more extreme positions. But his rage at the upstart Octavian knew no bounds, and throughout the next few months, while the two shared the spotlight in Rome, Antony took every opportunity to ignore and demean the young man, going so far as to withhold Octavian's rightful inheritance and stall the official adoption proceedings. But whatever personal slights were inflicted on him, Octavian was satisfied with having divorced Antony from the Senate. As a part of Antony's political shift, he exchanged the offer of clemency for the liberators with forced exile. He pushed through obscure foreign appointments for a lot of them, forcing them out of Italy so they would not get in the way of the Caesarians as they re-entrenched. He also forced through a Cisalpine Gaul proconsular appointment for himself to take effect as soon as he left office. This meant cutting short the term of the current governor, Decimus Brutus, who was not likely to give up his position without a fight. One of the liberators, maintaining his strategic placement at the head of an army just north of Rome, was of the utmost importance for the remaining Republicans, and Antony relished the opportunity not only to put himself in that all-important province, but to remove an obvious threat at the same time, hopefully regaining the trust of Caesar's legions by declaring war on one of the dictator's assassins along the way. Antony called in 5 legions stationed in Macedonia and ordered them to cross the Adriatic and meet him in Brundisium. When his term as consul ended, he would march them north and force Brutus to capitulate. But as autumn gave way to winter, Antony's position began to deteriorate. In September of 44 BC, in retaliation for turning against the Senate, Cicero aimed his considerable rhetorical artillery directly at the consul and opened fire. Using as a model the attacks on Philip II, Alexander the Great's father, by the Greek orator Demosthenes, Cicero delivered a series of scathing orations, collectively known as the Philippics, denouncing Antony. He asked the Senate to declare the dangerous consul an enemy of the state, while going out of his way to heap praise on Octavian, who he had clearly determined was the lesser of the two Caesarian evils. Cicero succeeded in turning public opinion against Antony, but the orations were probably the final nail in his coffin. In a few months, when a reconciled Antony and Octavian meet to discuss the fate of their enemies, Antony will be uncompromising on the question of Cicero. The old windbag was dead. Dead, dead, dead. Even worse for Antony, though, word came in November that two of the five Macedonian legions were defecting to Octavian's banner. The young man was lucky to have spent the months leading up to Caesar's assassination in Greece and had become quite popular with the troops in Macedonia. For the first time, it wasn't just the name of Caesar, but the personal magnetism of Octavian himself that was having an effect on the balance of power. With the army going to Octavian and Cicero lining up the Senate to support the young Caesar and the people turning against him, Antony knew he had to act fast. Before his term as consul ended, he collected the three legions still loyal to him and marched for Cisalpine Gaul. He would dislodge the assassin Brutus and hold the rich and strategically important province for himself. Plus, no one had yet taken into account the tens of thousands of troops stationed in Gaul and Spain. The officers in charge of the legions of Western Europe were his personal friends and the soldiers his longtime comrades. Antony was confident that they would back him over the growing Octavian senatorial alliance. At the end of 44 BC, he marched out of Rome bloodied, but not beaten. Next week, Antony will bottle up the governor of Cisalpine Gaul, Decimus Brutus, and nearly starve him into submission. But the new consuls for the year 43 BC will raise armies and march to Brutus's relief, having already followed Cicero's advice by declaring Antony an enemy of the state. Marching with them, headed towards his first battle, will be the newly appointed propraetor Octavian. Though for the briefest of moments Antony and Octavian will find themselves on opposite sides, they will soon come into an agreement, forming an alliance along with Caesar's old consular colleague Lepidus. And while the first triumvirate had been a powerful political force, it had nothing on the brutal ruthlessness of this new alliance, the second triumvirate. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 48, The Second Triumvirate. On January the 1st, 43 BC, the annual rollover of office holders took place in Rome. Praetors, aediles, and quaestors stepped down from their position, and new men took their place. In keeping with the long-established custom, the men on their way out stepped laterally into prorogued offices in the provinces. Praetors became propraetors, consuls became proconsuls. But what had in the past been a relatively boring reshuffling of the imperial bureaucracy was now a flashpoint for confrontation. Mark Antony, newly minted proconsul, had been slated to take over Macedonia, but in the last days of his consulship, he decided that he didn't want Macedonia. He wanted the rich and strategically important province of Cisalpine Gaul. So he had the tribunes propose and ratify a change in assignments. Except that the term of the current governor, Decimus Brutus, had not yet expired, and he refused to recognize the new orders. This being a new age of Roman politics, an age defined by force rather than persuasion, Antony simply gathered an army and marched for the Po Valley to force Brutus out. Obviously, there were special circumstances surrounding Antony's desire to take Cisalpine Gaul and dislodge Brutus in the process, namely that the latter had been a central figure in the Liberator conspiracy to kill Julius Caesar, but it is nonetheless unsettling how easy it had become for legion to fight legion. 100 years ago, two Roman armies lined up against one another would have been an unthinkable shame. Now, it was as regular as clockwork. By the time January rolled around, Antony was, in fact, already in the Po Valley, with his three legions besieging Brutus in the town of Mutina. The new consuls for the year, Aulus Hirtius and Gaius Vibius Pansa, had both been strong supporters of Caesar and had fought alongside him during the civil wars. Indeed, their turn in the consulship had been arranged by the dictator prior to his death. But with Caesar dead, both men reverted back to moderate republicanism. For them, Caesar was a singular figure, and with him gone, it was time for the natural order of things to be restored. So, despite their longtime fellow traveling with Antony, neither of them had much stomach for his continuation of the extreme Caesarian agenda he was pursuing. When the Senate decided that Antony had gone too far in claiming Cisalpine Gaul for himself and declared him an enemy of the state, both consuls were ready to lead armies north and put down their erstwhile friend. Octavian welcomed the new year with relish. Thus far in his brief and meteoric rise up the political ladder, he had not actually stepped foot on the ladder. His prominence was due entirely to his name. The armies he led and the support he enjoyed was all private, and he badly needed some official cover to make himself legitimate. But he was at this point not yet 20 years old and barely qualified to be a military tribune, let alone the general of an army. But he was determined to not let a little thing like the rules hold him back, and he engineered a rather odd point of entry into the government, skipping the formal offices themselves and jumping directly to an appointment as propraetor. No doubt, the legions Octavian controlled played an important role in the Senate throwing out the book for the young man. He was asked to merge his legions with the consular armies headed to face Antony, and soon after taking office, he was on his way north to battle in defense of, get this, the Republic. Hirtius was already in the Po Valley when Octavian and the two defecting Macedonian legions arrived. Still years away from becoming Augustus, undisputed master of the Roman Empire, Octavian was immediately put in his place by Hirtius, who treated the junior officer like the junior officer he was. Hirtius took control of the Macedonian legions and made sure Octavian understood that whatever his name, a consul's word, was still the law in camp. Brutus was in dire straits and desperately needed relief, but Hirtius did not press Antony right away. He wanted to make sure that when he attacked, Antony would have no hope of victory. Julius Caesar may have been the luckiest general alive, but he was dead now. An overwhelming force might actually count for something again. So he waited while his colleague Pansa finished raising three new legions. Antony would stand no chance against their combined armies. At the beginning of spring, Pansa was ready and began to march north. Antony was fully aware that he would soon be outnumbered, so he broke off his focus on Brutus and headed down to ambush Pansa before he could link up with Hirtius and Octavian. At the small village of Forum Gallorum, Antony's veteran legions surprised the raw recruits led by Pansa and crushed them with relative ease. Pansa himself was injured in the fighting. The only drawback, though, to easy victory is that it breeds complacency, and while Antony's men strolled merrily back to camp, they were surprised by Hirtius' army, who had marched south when the consul realized what Antony was up to. The only thing that saved Antony's legions was the onset of night, which forced an end to what was shaping up to be a slaughter. Missing all the fun was Octavian, who was apparently left behind to guard the camp, a fact that Antony would use to needle his rival for years. Remember Forum Gallorum when you... Oh no, wait, you weren't there, were you? But 6 days later, Octavian would be present for the assault on Antony's camp. Hirtius may have lost the edge of overwhelming force, but Antony's men were in bad shape and looked ready for a finishing off. The consular army stormed Antony's camp and broke through the gates. Octavian, for the first time, found himself in the thick of battle. Legend has it that when Hirtius was killed near Antony's tent, that it was Octavian who dragged his body out of harm's way. Though a later, equally repeated rumor has Octavian secretly killing Hirtius in the din of battle so he could seize control of the army from a general who had disrespected him. Both stories are likely fabrications. Octavian's career will be filled with these kinds of contradictory myths and slanders. Put simply, though, we know that he was there, we know that he fought, and we know that in his first real battle, he was on the winning side. Antony was forced to retreat, and the siege of Brutus was lifted. Fueling the later slanderous rumor that Octavian somehow managed to murder a consul in broad daylight while surrounded by literally hundreds of men, the other consul, Pansa, died of his wounds a few days after the Battle of Mutina. Allegedly, he was poisoned by a Greek doctor on Octavian's orders. Why would Octavian secretly order the death of a consul? Because with Hirtius dead, Pansa was the only thing standing between Octavian and control of 8 full legions. Whatever part Octavian did or did not play, the deaths of Hirtius and Pansa would be two of the more fateful deaths in Roman history. Because once control of the legions fell into his lap, Octavian never looked back. Brutus tried briefly to assert command in his role as governor of the province, but Octavian would have none of it. Brutus wasn't even allowed into camp. Lucky for him, he had been rescued by a man who probably wanted his head even more than the man he had been saved from. Brutus, though, was undaunted and led his legions through the Alps in pursuit of Antony, who was making for Gaul. Technically, he and Octavian were on the same side, but Octavian declined to move an inch and remained camped in Cisalpine Gaul, leaving Brutus hanging in the mountains alone and unsupported. Meanwhile, Antony arrived in Gaul and hooked up with the 11 legions stationed there under the command of Marcus Lepidus. Brutus had no hope of defeating Antony now, but when he turned around, he realized he was staring down the barrel of Octavian and his 8 legions. Sensing disaster, his troops deserted, getting out of the mountains any way they could. Brutus himself fell into the hands of a Gallic tribe looking to make nice with Antony, who received a head in a box a few days later. Back in Rome, the Republicans initially cheered the defeat of Antony, but the savvy could see that this was no victory at all. Caesar's son and Caesar's best friend now controlled between them some 20 legions, and unfortunately, the interests of the two men were no longer at odds. In the east, Marcus Brutus and Cassius were raising armies to destroy the Caesarian menace before it strangled the Republic forever. Divided, it was possible Antony and Octavian might each be beaten by the liberator armies, but combined, they would be unstoppable. So what at first looked like a victory for Republicans turned out to be another crucial step towards their demise. Octavian wasted no time after the death of the consuls to raise himself into their vacated seats. He sent a contingent of centurions to the Senate demanding that they name him consul. The Senate, trying to maintain some hold on the situation, refused. Octavian was unperturbed by the rebuke, though, and simply packed up his army and headed to Rome. He camped outside the walls and asked again. This time, his request was granted. Satisfied, the newly minted consul Octavian headed back to Cisalpine Gaul to make the final arrangements for his anticipated meeting with Antony. All summer, envoys had crossed back and forth across the Alps to work out the details of the summit. Antony detested Octavian, and Octavian in turn despised Antony. But for now, it was clear that it was in both their interests to join forces. The future? Well, we'll burn that bridge when we get to it. In October of 43 BC, with Lepidus acting as broker, Antony and Octavian met on a small island in the river Lavinius and for 2 straight days hashed out the fate of the Roman Empire. The upshot of the meeting was the creation of the innocuous-sounding Commission of 3 for the ordering of the state, which has become known to us, though, as the Second Triumvirate. The triumvirate included Antony, Octavian, and Marcus Lepidus, whose inclusion seems to have been to act as a rubber stamp for Antony's decisions, but the old general was trusted by both men to be a silent partner. This was between Octavian and Antony. It was agreed that the first order of business would be crushing Brutus and Cassius. But though the two triumvirs led now a combined army of some 100,000 troops, more than enough for any war with Brutus and Cassius, they were light on cash. No money for paychecks, no troops. No troops, no army. No army, no war. So the triumvirate decided to revive prescription, a practice Julius Caesar had steadfastly refused to engage in to raise the necessary funds. So where Caesar had played for greatness, eschewing prescriptions to demonstrate what a wonderful guy he was, Antony and Octavian played for keeps. The process would be the same as during the reign of Sulla. A list of 2,500 names would be drawn up, the names would be posted in the forum, the property and lives of those named would be forfeit. The enemies of the Caesarians would be eliminated, and the necessary funds for their campaigns against Brutus and Cassius would be secured. The coming terror would eradicate the last of the real defenders of the Republic. Defenders, for example, like Cicero. In the negotiations, Octavian was unable to persuade Antony to spare Cicero's life. For Antony, leaving the pompous old order alive was a deal-breaker, and in the end, Octavian was forced to relent. A new order was coming, and there was no place in it for eloquent defenders of Republican virtue. In December of 43 BC, soldiers caught up with Cicero, and he stoically offered them his neck, asking only that they get it right the first time. Octavian, Antony, and Lepidus now ruled the Roman Empire as a three-headed dictator. Unlike the previous triumvirate, this new incarnation was legally ratified by the assemblies for a term of 5 years. The word of the triumvirs was law. They posted the prescription list and let their bloody reign begin. Heads rolled, property was seized, men of high standing were reduced to hiding in attics and basements. Antony and Octavian observed it all without compassion. It is said that Antony demanded to review every prescribed head himself, even if it interrupted dinner. The only problem with the plan, though, besides, you know, the gross inhumanity of it all, was that by flooding the market with the newly prescribed homes, the real estate market bottomed out, and the triumvirs raised far less money than they originally anticipated. They were forced to post more names on the prescribed lists. When that didn't work, they were forced to outright steal from safe deposit boxes held in the Temple of the Vestas. And when that wasn't enough, they did the really unthinkable. They instituted a tax on the people of Italy, who had, from time immemorial, been exempt from taxation. Even during the days of Rome's initial rise to power over the peninsula, conquered tribes were usually asked for soldiers rather than cash as the price of their servitude. The new tax, in fact, would prove to be far more unpopular than the prescriptions. But the triumvirate, unpopular as they were making themselves, finally scraped together enough to fund their war. It was time to head east and deal with the murderers of Caesar. Leaving Lepidus in control of Italy, Antony and Octavian ferried 19 legions across the Adriatic, landing near Dyrrhachium. It was not an easy crossing. Despite controlling all the lands of the Western Empire, the triumvirate had virtually no presence on the seas, a fact that would come back to haunt them time and again. But they managed to get across before a Republican naval blockade could be firmly established. Once they disembarked, Antony sent 8 legions ahead on a scouting mission. The triumvirs knew that Brutus and Cassius were out there somewhere, but they didn't know where exactly. Where exactly turned out to be the town of Philippi in Thrace, about halfway down the road to the Hellespont. Brutus and Cassius had set up strong defensive positions, building camps atop 2 hills, and then building a north-south wall between their camps. Further north of their position was steep, rocky hills, and further south was marshlands. If the triumvirs, marching east, were going to attack, it was going to be head-on. But battle is not what Cassius, the senior general and tactical mastermind of the liberators, was after. He fully expected to sit tight and wait for a naval blockade to take its toll. Macedonia is notoriously hard country and could in no way support the 100,000-some men of the triumvir army for long. As Brutus and Cassius waited for Antony and Octavian to arrive, 150 ships filled the Adriatic, cutting them off from their supply line in Italy. All Brutus and Cassius had to do was repel whatever assault the triumvirs attempted and then wait for them to starve. But unfortunately for the liberators, while the blockade worked like a charm, the whole repelling whatever assault the triumvirs attempted thing didn't work out exactly as planned. When the liberator position was discovered, Antony immediately led the triumvir legions to confront Brutus and Cassius. Octavian, however, once again debilitated by sickness, was forced to remain behind in Dyrrhachium, adding fuel to the persistent rumor of cowardice. Antony arrived outside the liberator camps in late September 42 BC and quickly assessed the situation. The north side was indeed no good for an approach, and a frontal assault would be suicidal. The southern swamp, though, ugly a route as it was, showed some promise. Cassius, in the southernmost camp, obviously did not believe he had to worry about an approach through the bog and had set up no defensive line. So, taking a page from the playbook of Hannibal, Antony decided his best bet was to lead a force through the muck and appear suddenly where no one expected him to be. With luck, he would be able to surprise Cassius and get at the underbelly of the liberator army before they knew what hit him. Keeping the bulk of his army skirmishing around as a distraction, Antony sent his engineers into the swamp and had them begin constructing a causeway. A few days into the work, Octavian arrived from Dyrrhachium. He was still in bad shape, but had no intention of letting Antony hog all the glory. Plus, more importantly, he could not allow Antony to seize the opportunity a great victory would provide to turn on his young colleague. Overall command of the operation was firmly in Antony's hands, but Octavian planned to be standing right next to him the whole time. They would rise or fall together. The engineers worked for days in the swamp, slowly cutting and building a plank road through the muck. On October the 3rd, though, just as they reached the other side, their cover was blown. Sentries finally noticed something was going on in the impassable swamp and alerted Cassius. The liberator general acted fast, ordering that fortifications be built into the swamp, bisecting the causeway and trapping the lead insertion force in enemy territory. Recognizing that the jig was up, Antony ordered a full-on attack, targeting the place where Cassius's main defensive wall met the swamp. Taken off guard by the sudden frontal assault, Cassius's men were unable to prevent Antony from breaking through. At the same time, Brutus saw that the camps of Octavian and Antony now were totally unprotected. Rather than send his men to reinforce Cassius, Brutus ordered them to seize the triumvir camps. At worst, any success Antony achieved would be offset by the loss of his bases, and at best, he would be beaten and then have nowhere to retreat to. Octavian was supposed to be leading the camp forces, but when Brutus's legions stormed the wall, he was nowhere to be found. There is no accounting for him at this point, though it was rumored that, recognizing Brutus would easily overrun the reserve forces, that Octavian hid out in the swamp until the battle was over. Antony, on the other hand, was in the middle of intense fighting near Cassius's camp. Eventually, he was able to storm the walls and take the base, which left the battle at a peculiar draw. Antony in control of Cassius's camp, Brutus in control of Antony's. But for Cassius, it was all a loss. He had retreated with a small force to another nearby hill and watched the battle wind down. There are two accounts of what happened next. In the first, dust from the battle so obscured everyone's vision that Cassius did not realize Brutus had seized the triumvir camps, knowing only that his own army had been defeated. Assuming the worst, he ordered a slave to take his life, knowing that he was dead one way or the other. In the other account, Cassius had gotten word of Brutus's victory, but was ashamed that Brutus, a lesser general, had succeeded while he had failed, and in his shame, he took his own life. Whatever the reason, in the aftermath of the battle, Cassius's beheaded body was discovered. When news reached Brutus, he mourned for his brother-in-law. He was, said Brutus, the last of the Romans. Brutus regrouped and refortified his position in the aftermath of the first battle, having looted anything serviceable from the triumvir camps. But with Cassius, the far more respected commander, gone, discipline began to break down in the Liberator army. Brutus attempted to revert to the original strategy of holding out long enough to let the naval blockade take its toll, but he was pressed by his officers to attack. They may have listened to Cassius, but they were not convinced that Brutus wasn't simply afraid of another battle. Like Pompey before him, Brutus was goaded into battle against his better judgment. On October the 23rd, the final confrontation came. No trick maneuvers or fancy tactics were employed. The two armies charged at each other and fought in close quarters for hours, until finally, the triumvirs pushed Brutus back. The Liberator army broke down and scattered. Brutus managed to keep four undersized legions in coherent enough order to lead them up a hill where he could plan his next move. But, assessing the damage, it was obvious what his next move would be. His troops were surrounded and already talking openly of surrender. So Brutus mingled with his men, bidding them goodbye and embracing his officers. He then walked away from them all, picked out a nice spot, and fell on his sword. The battles at Philippi not only marked the effective death of the Republic, it also marked the pinnacle of Mark Antony's career. Though Octavian was, well, present, sort of, there was no doubt who had earned the victory. At this moment, Mark Antony was the most powerful man in Rome. His ambitions, of course, reached for even greater heights, but he would never reach those summits. Philippi would be his crowning glory. Though no one would have believed it at the time, from here on out, Antony's career will slowly but surely unravel. Finally, outmaneuvered politically and defeated militarily by Octavian, Antony would himself commit suicide. But, ignorant of his fate, Antony reveled in his victory. Brutus's body was brought to him, and knowing that there was much to be said for graceful victory, he honored his old comrade, draping the body with his general's cloak. But when Antony moved on to other concerns, the corpse passed into the hands of Octavian, who allowed Brutus's memory no further dignity. He ordered that the head be chopped off, sent back to Rome, and thrown at the foot of a statue to Julius Caesar, thus always to those who stand in the way of tyrants. But of course, as with the last round of civil wars, the end is not always the end. Though Philippi was effectively the end of resistance to Antony and Octavian, in practice, there were still battles to be fought. Sextus Pompey, the son of Pompey the Great, had reemerged following his defeat in Spain and was now in control of the Liberator Navy. Depending on who you were talking to, Sextus was either the noble admiral of the Republican fleet or a dread pirate. But everyone agreed that he was a massive thorn in the side of the triumvirs. Whatever climax had allegedly played out at Philippi, Sextus was not going to be giving up anytime soon. If the triumvirs couldn't be defeated on the battlefield, Sextus decided the next best thing would be to literally starve them of support. Let's see the triumvirs try to control a capital that is about to have its food supply cut off completely. Hungry citizens are never complacent citizens. Breaking Sextus's naval blockade of Italy would be the overarching concern of Octavian for years as he tried to solidify his hold on the Western Empire. Antony, as the senior triumvir, remained in the east where he planned to follow up his victory at Philippi with an even greater victory over the Parthian Empire. Once the Parthians were defeated, he would be in a strong enough position to break the triumvirate and knock troublesome Octavian out of the picture for good. That was the plan, anyway. Next week, there will be no episode. I know I just skipped a week like a month ago, but I'm going to have to do it again. The soon-to-be Mrs. History of Rome is graduating on Friday, and we are hosting out-of-town dignitaries throughout the week. So I'm going to be a good host and not hole up with my laptop. I hope you understand. But we will return in 2 weeks and trace Octavian's attempt to maintain order in the West and Antony's disastrous attempts to conquer the East. Finally, I would like to wish a happy birthday to faithful listener George in Los Angeles. I hope you like the book. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 49, Apollo and Dionysus. Last time, Antony and Octavian, but really, Antony, defeated the combined armies of Brutus and Cassius at the Battle of Philippi in late 42 BC, just 2 years removed from the assassination of Julius Caesar, an assassination that was supposed to herald the return of the Republic. The Romans were as far removed from democracy as they had been under the Tarquins. Power now resided fully in the hands of just three men, Octavian, Antony, and Lepidus. Their word was law, no debate, and no appeal. But of course, it was not the final ambition of any one of the three to rule with colleagues. They all aimed to hold the prize for themselves. For now, the Triple Alliance held because their triumph was too fresh not to be threatened on all sides by men who, having submitted, now waited for any opportunity to throw off the triumvirate yoke. But, even understanding their precarious position, the dynamic within the triumvirate began to change. Lepidus, who had been left in charge of Italy while the other two triumvirs went east, was about to find himself the odd man out in what had always been a struggle between Octavian and Antony. After Philippi, the balance of power that would define the next few years of alliance and rivalry between the two lead triumvirs began to shake out. Mark Antony stayed in the east with 8 legions, while Octavian took the remaining troops, old Caesarian veterans, and surrendered liberator soldiers alike, back to Italy. The two triumvirs had signed an agreement granting Antony power over the empire east of the Adriatic and Octavian the west, except in Greater Gaul, which remained in Antony's hands. Each would focus on their sphere of influence to solidify power for the triumvirate. Antony obviously had the more glamorous position. It had long been a Roman ambition to invade Parthia and move the empire into the eastern interior. It was now up to Antony to pick up the baton dropped first by Crassus and then by Julius Caesar and carry it across the finish line. Octavian, meanwhile, was left with the unenviable task of demobilizing tens of thousands of veterans, finding them lands to settle on in an overcrowded continent without any money left in the treasury to purchase the necessary land. While Antony went off to play conquering hero, Octavian was left to play bureaucratic dunce, caught between angry veterans and angry citizens. Plus, the one real internal threat to the triumvirate remaining after Philippi was left to Octavian to deal with. Sextus Pompey, the now 25-year-old son of Pompey the Great, had gathered a pirate fleet and taken control of Sicily. For Antony, it was all eastern queens, never-ending banquets, and planning for greatness. For Octavian, it was grain shortages, general strikes, and angry mobs. The main problem facing the triumvirate, which was fast becoming a biumvirate, especially now that the rich province of Spain had been taken away from Lepidus and given to Octavian, was that the state coffers were empty. No thought had been spared for the future when the triumvirate built their war machine to face Brutus and Cassius, but, having won now, they were faced with the consequences of victory. In particular, promises of land had been made to the soldiers to entice them into the army in the first place and then keep them there through the hard times. Now the bill was coming due. In the past, as with Pompey's veterans or Julius Caesar's veterans, the riches won in battle were used to purchase property for the retiring soldiers. Though there was no enshrined eminent domain protection that required the state to pay a fair price for seized land, it was simply practical to do so. It kept hurt feelings to a minimum and left everyone, soldier and citizen alike, relatively happy. But Octavian and Antony had not conquered foreign lands and returned home seated atop a massive pile of cash. They had barely emerged from a bitter civil war that had left them very, very poor, rather than very, very rich. Back in Rome, Octavian faced a choice. Renege on the promise to the some 40,000 soldiers scheduled for retirement, or simply take by force the land needed to keep his word. It should come as no surprise to anyone that in this new world order, where soldiers were the principal currency of politics, that Octavian chose the latter. He marked down sites across Italy to settle the veterans and arbitrarily confiscated the necessary land. Some of the seizures came from large senatorial estates that could absorb the loss, but just as often, the settlement swallowed entire freeholdings. Families whose only crime was living where Octavian's finger landed on a map were thrown off their land. The public was outraged, and as the dispossessed streamed into Rome, where else could they go? Riots broke out between ex-soldiers and evicted citizens. Octavian realized he could only push the civilian population so far before they would come after him with pitchforks, and so he called a halt to the confiscations. But unfortunately, what had been seized already was not enough to satisfy all the veteran claims. So now, rather than facing angry mobs of citizens, Octavian faced angry mobs of ex-soldiers. On top of everything else, Sextus Pompey, having taken control of Sicily with a fleet that far outgunned anything the triumvirs could muster at this point, began a blockade of Italy that left the all-important grain supply lines broken. Octavian, in a word, was miserable. By contrast, out in the eastern provinces, Mark Antony had styled himself as the new incarnation of Dionysus and was doing his best to live up to the ecstatic lifestyle that defined the Greek god of wine and abundance. He indulged endlessly in everything the provinces had to offer, and going far beyond what would be considered good taste back in Rome, the new Dionysus actively joined in the rituals of the eastern mystery cults. Antony traveled slowly from Greece into Asia Minor and settled in Cilicia on the southern coast. From this base of operations, he planned to raise money and men for his invasion of Parthia. But having already bled the provinces dry during the years of civil war, there was little left that Rome could squeeze out of the natives. Realizing increased taxes weren't getting him anywhere fast, Antony's gaze naturally turned south across the sea to the rich lands of Egypt. Conveniently, now fully in control of her country, Cleopatra had styled herself as the new Isis. In Egyptian mythology, Isis was the sister and wife of Osiris, who had long been seen as an Eastern analog for, wait for it, Dionysus. The match was too perfect not to embrace completely. Antony invited Cleopatra to meet with him in Cilicia, and the queen agreed. The alliance they forged was mutually beneficial. Antony got the revenue stream he needed for his further adventures, and Cleopatra got a new Roman patron to protect her position in Egypt. Julius Caesar had been the personal guarantor of her rule, and with him dead, she needed a powerful ally in Rome to maintain the throne. It was a match made in heaven, literally, according to their mutual propaganda campaign. Antony decided to follow Cleopatra to Alexandria for the winter. Beyond the political alliance they cemented, the winter spent in each other's company produced twins. 41 BC arrived chock full of bad news for both triumvirs. In Italy, Antony's brother Lucius, who was consul for the year, conspired with Antony's wife Fulvia to foment a rebellion against Octavian. Just how in the loop Mark Antony was remains unclear. Of course, he claimed he knew nothing about it, but that was after the fact, after the rebellion failed spectacularly. Certainly, he took no active part in the machinations. He had other things to worry about. Well aware that the Romans were planning an invasion, the Parthians had launched a preemptive strike into Syria. Antony quickly abandoned his love nest in Alexandria and returned to military life. The protracted, if ultimately minor, uprising in Italy against Octavian was hatched by Fulvia and Lucius Antony once the breadth of Octavian's political troubles became apparent. The young man was struggling mightily with the thorny issues that come when there is too little land and too little grain, and he was traveling fast down a road of pleasing none of the people, none of the time. To top things off, his aristocratic, pampered upbringing had left him with something of a tin ear politically. In the midst of a grain shortage caused by Sextus Pompey's blockade, for example, Octavian attended a lavish banquet where each guest came dressed as a different Greek god. In contrast to Antony's embrace of the indulgent and emotional Dionysus, Octavian came dressed as Apollo, god of light and rationality. Octavian meant only to have a bit of fun and begin the process of associating himself publicly with the divine Apollo, but instead the public was outraged that while they starved, self-styled gods were eating all the food. If public opinion polls had existed, Octavian's numbers would have been in the toilet. So Fulvia and Lucius Antony stirred up resentment amongst the struggling veterans while simultaneously picking up the cause of the dispossessed and now starving ex-freeholders. They managed to raise some legions of disgruntled citizens and sent word around to the standing armies loyal to Antony that this was all being done with his approval. But the Antonian generals were skeptical and held back from what was clearly a half-baked scheme to oust Octavian. They were talking about directly assaulting the heir of Julius Caesar. He may be unpopular, but still, that was not a thing done lightly. If it was what Antony wanted, so be it, but let the orders come from him. Until then, they were staying put. Octavian sent his friend Agrippa to deal with the floundering rebel army, which holed up in the fortress town of Perusia in central Italy. After a long siege, the town finally fell to Octavian's forces. It was a minor victory against a weak opponent, but it had the effect of giving Octavian a military victory in his own right, without anyone being able to point to a more senior officer who really won the battle, even though Agrippa really won the battle. It was an important legitimizing moment for the young statesman, who badly needed a legitimizing moment. Lucius Antony committed suicide just as Perusia fell, and Fulvia went into exile. She died of an illness the next year in Greece after an emotional confrontation with Antony, who blamed her for the whole unnecessary fiasco. In her attempt to exploit Octavian's weakness, she had left him stronger than ever. Perhaps smarting from the unexpected betrayal by the Antonys, and also glowing with renewed confidence, in early 40 BC, Octavian broke a clear provision in his agreement with Antony to leave Gaul alone. The governor of the province, a staunch Antonian general named Calenus, suddenly died, and without consulting his triumvirate partner, Octavian went north and took command of the 11 legions stationed there. The move was nothing less than an act of war so far as Antony was concerned. Leaving the east in the hands of his capable lieutenants, Antony immediately headed back to Italy to confront his young colleague. With Octavian seemingly intent on breaking the triumvirate, Antony simultaneously sent out feelers to Sextus Pompey in Sicily, looking for an alliance. He found the young Republican amenable to a joint operation, and Antony signaled that Sextus should harass the coast of Italy at will to put pressure on Octavian. Antony also picked up the support of the Republican fleet that had once upon a time blockaded the Adriatic prior to the Battle of Philippi. In what was shaping up to be the final showdown between Antony and Octavian, the old Republicans were clearly casting their lot with Antony. In an attempt to blunt the efforts of Antony's diplomacy, Octavian decided that it was high time he took a wife and arranged a marriage with the widowed Scribania. She was a much older woman and seemed a poor match until you consider that she was also Sextus Pompey's aunt-in-law. In the highly familial world of Roman politics, Octavian was signaling his own willingness to ally with Sextus. At the very least, he hoped to make the young admiral think twice before taking sides against his new uncle. Antony and his fleet arrived in Brundisium and found the city locked up tight by Octavian's garrison. A siege began, and Octavian hurried down with his armies to assess the situation. Was this the beginning of the end of the triumvirate? In an interesting turn of events, the answer turned out to be an emphatic no. Centurions in both camps had had enough of civil war. They had had enough of killing each other. They were friends, neighbors, comrades, in some cases family. Enough was enough. You know the old saying, what if they threw a war and no one showed up? At Brundisium, that's exactly what happened. The centurions went to their respective commanders and said, look, you do what you want, but we're not going to battle. We would suggest coming to some kind of an agreement, because the only way this is going to end now, if you both refuse to compromise, is some kind of single combat gladiatorial death match for control of the Empire. Which is fine, we'll cheer you on, but we're not doing your fighting for you anymore. Left mutually defenseless, Antony and Octavian decided to deal. The Triumvirate Alliance was reconfirmed, and the East-West power sharing was formalized, with Antony crucially conceding Gaul to Octavian. Lepidus still hung in there in his official triumvir, and was granted the province of Africa, but by now he was irrelevant. The third wheel triumvir will make one last big play to get back in the game after the campaign against Sextus Pompey in Sicily, but it will only net him a forced retirement. The treaty was met with relief by the people of Rome, and further celebrated when news came of the final deal sealer. Newly widowed Antony would wed Octavian's sister, Octavia. The triumvirate was one big happy family again. They all returned to Rome together to celebrate the coming nuptials. Meanwhile, Sextus Pompey, who had so recently been courted by both triumvirs, was now out in the political cold again and returned to his blockade. But though he was not going to play the part of kingmaker, his strangulation of the grain supply routes was taking its toll in Rome, and the triumvirs came under immense pressure to come to terms with him. After initially refusing any compromise, the triumvirate finally bowed to the ever-rising grain prices, and in the summer of 39 BC, invited Pompey to the bargaining table. In exchange for lifting the blockade, the triumvirs offered to legalize his hold over Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica, making the young man governor of all three islands. In addition, they would slate him for a consulship the next year. After mulling it over, Sextus agreed. By legalizing Sextus, the triumvirs also invited back into the fold all the Republican exiles who had fled to his banner. Proscribed families, lucky to get out of Rome alive, were now allowed to return to their homes. One young family who took the triumvirate up on their offer of clemency was Tiberius Claudius Nero, his 19-year-old wife Livia Drusilla, and their infant son, also named Tiberius. They had been on the run since Tiberius the Elder had joined and then fled from Fulvia's ill-advised revolt 2 years before. Tiberius was something of a doofus who always managed to find himself on the wrong side of any given fight, going back to his stance against the first triumvirate 15 years earlier. His only lasting contribution to Roman history was the fact that he agreed to a divorce when Octavian announced that he intended to marry Livia, having fallen madly in love with her at first sight. The only complication was that both Livia and Scribonia were pregnant. Devoid of sentimentality, Octavian divorced Scribonia on the day she gave birth to his only biological child, a daughter named Julia, in October 39 BC. He and Livia were wed 3 days after she gave birth to her second son, Drusus. With these marital ties lined up, the Julio-Claudian dynasty that we have all come to know and love finally fell into place. The infant Tiberius would, in time, be adopted by Augustus and then inherit the throne, becoming Rome's second emperor. His brother Drusus was the father of Claudius, grandfather of Caligula, and great-grandfather of Nero. Germanicus is in there too, but we'll get to all that. Almost immediately after securing the treaty with the triumvirate, Sextus realized that he had made a terrible deal. He was already in control of Sicily, Corsica, and Sardinia. There was nothing the triumvirate could have done about that. So he had bargained for control over things he already controlled. In return, he had given up the mantle of last defender of the Republic. The money and support that flooded his way for playing this part suddenly dried up. All his allies had returned home or given up on him. Octavian was no fan of the agreement either, but with the situation in the West finally settled, Antony clapped down on any talk of further aggression against Sextus. He needed things quiet in Rome if he was ever going to get the eternally delayed Parthian campaign off the ground. But by 38 BC, with Antony back in the east planning his war, and Sextus disrupting the grain supply again in an attempt to stay relevant, Octavian decided to ignore his colleague's wishes and deal with the meddlesome Pompey once and for all. With the defection of one of Sextus's top captains, Octavian decided to strike while the iron was hot. He now knew where young Pompey was and exactly what his defenses were. If he could clear Sextus off the table quickly, Antony would return from the east with Octavian the undisputed ruler of the Western Empire. It was a seductive thought, and so he voided the treaty with Sextus and attacked. Octavian planned a two-pronged assault of Sicily. He ordered a fleet led by Sextus's ex-captain to sail south and attack the north coast of the island. Meanwhile, the triumvir himself would lead another force in from the east. He hoped to quickly pin Sextus down in Messana, just across the straits from mainland Italy. But this initial thrust turned into a complete debacle. The fleet coming south was challenged, defeated, and forced to retreat. Octavian quickly shifted his plans and decided to try to rush through the straits of Messana and link up with the retreating fleet. Two prongs were nice, but if this wasn't going to be as easy as he thought, one great big prong was better than two little prongs. But Octavian was an inexperienced naval commander, and as soon as he set sail, Sextus pounced and drove Octavian's fleet into the rocks. Octavian barely escaped with his life. Most of his fleet was either on fire or dashed on the rocks. In a cruel twist of fate, the next morning, Octavian and the survivors awoke to a sudden storm, and what few ships they had left sunk. Octavian struck while the iron was hot, all right, and it burned him badly. Humiliated but undeterred, Octavian called for Agrippa to help plan a new invasion. To give his friend all the resources he needed, Octavian had the 26-year-old appointed consul for the year 37 BC. That whole year was spent building a new fleet. But because Octavian wanted to lull Sextus into a false sense of security, and because any attempt to construct anything in a regular port would likely be harassed by constant attack, Agrippa designed and built canals linking an inland lake to the sea. Then, under the cover of a dense forest, out of sight, he built and trained a massive new navy on the lake. Of more immediate importance to Octavian, on January the 1st, 37 BC, the same day that Agrippa assumed the consulship, the term of the Second Triumvirate officially expired. He and Antony were still in power, obviously, but technically they had no standing within the political system. So a summit was scheduled to work out the details of renewing the pact. Antony returned from the east and his opening skirmishes with the Parthians in the spring, and at Tarentum, he and Octavian met and hashed out the terms. It was roughly the same deal as before. Octavian would control the west and Antony the east. This time, rather than sealing the deal with a marriage, a troop exchange was arranged. Octavian needed ships for his war with Sextus, and Antony needed ground legions for his invasion of Parthia. So Antony traded 120 ships for four of Octavian's legions. But in a move that would sow the seeds for the demise of the triumvirate, while Antony duly sent the ships, Octavian refused to live up to his end of the bargain and never sent the promised legions. Antony was furious at the betrayal, and it destroyed whatever trust he had left in his partner for good. War between them was now inevitable. It was just a matter of time. Agrippa shepherded the renewal of the triumvirate through the Senate and the assemblies, and having placed his friend back in official power, returned to the fleet that he would lead against Sextus. In the spring of 36 BC, the 300 ships, each bigger than anything Sextus commanded and equipped with the latest in grappling hook technology, sailed out into the Mediterranean. For this latest attempt to conquer Sicily, Octavian now envisioned a three-prong assault. With Agrippa attacking the north coast, he ordered Lepidus to land 10 legions on the southern coast and begin capturing as much territory as possible. With Sextus busy fighting on two fronts, Octavian himself would ferry more ground legions across the straits. Sextus would be overwhelmed. At first things went great. Lepidus landed and began capturing city after city. But when Agrippa attacked from the north, Sextus suspected that it was just a feint meant to distract from whatever Octavian was up to. So he left just enough ships to make a nice show of fighting Agrippa and led the rest around the horn into the Straits of Messana. Octavian, thinking he had outsmarted Sextus, had landed with a force to establish a beachhead and then found himself trapped by the sudden appearance of Sextus's fleet. Braving possible capture, Octavian slipped through the blockade in a small ship to link back up with the rest of his army. It was do-or-die time now. He had to get the rest of his army into Sicily or all would be lost. Rumors were already filtering in that Lepidus was talking alliance with Sextus. Octavian needed to fill the island with his own men before any deal was struck. Luckily, though, Sextus was spread thin and only had 300 ships left at his disposal. With so many blockading the straits, he was forced to leave some of the northern ports defenseless. Agrippa was able to easily capture and hold them. Octavian hooked back up with his legions on the mainland and sailed them north to land under the protection of Agrippa's fleet. Pretty soon, the transfer was complete. Totally outnumbered on land, Sextus gathered all of his ships at his stronghold in Messana. The only hope he had left now was to provoke a sea battle. In early September, he led his ships out of the harbor and went looking for Agrippa. The two fleets met off the northeast coast of the island, near the city of Nilochus. On paper, it was an even engagement, east side controlling 300 ships. But Agrippa's fleet was larger and more powerful. It was by no means a one-sided affair, but throughout the whole day's fighting, Sextus lost ships at a slightly faster rate. By the end of the day, the Pompeian captains determined that the cause was lost and began to surrender to Agrippa rather than keep fighting. With his navy captured, it was all over for Sextus. He took the 17 ships that remained uncaptured and sailed east. Over the course of the next year, he tried to find asylum and allies, but was rebuked at every turn. Unwilling to surrender, he was eventually captured in Anatolia and executed by a provincial governor loyal to the triumvirate. After Agrippa's victory at Nilochus, Octavian now stood alone in the west. There was no one left to challenge his rule. Well, almost no one. Lepidus, who had conquered most of Sicily during the invasion, suddenly decided to reassert himself in the triumvirate. He claimed by right of conquest Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica, and demanded that Octavian recognize his claim. Octavian scoffed at this notion. He had not gone through all this trouble to take Sicily just to give it away to a rival. He sent men into the ranks of Lepidus's legions to sow dissent. Lepidus, who was never very popular with the average grunt, watched in horror as his legions began to desert from his banner en masse. Without any leverage left, Lepidus met with Octavian and rescinded his claim. Octavian, seizing an opportunity to eliminate Lepidus from the balance of power, decided to unilaterally expel him from the triumvirate as punishment. From now on, though the name never caught on, it truly was a biumvirate. Lepidus retired to a plush estate on the Italian coast and lived another 20 years in comfortable obscurity. Next week, we'll head east to trace the ups and downs of Antony's campaigns against the Parthians. But as I said before, it was more downs than ups. The apex of Antony's career was the Battle of Philippi. Everything after that was just a slow descent into ruin. Completely in control of the West now, Octavian would use every tool at his disposal to turn public opinion against his colleague, particularly harping on the fact that Antony seemed to be going native, dressing in Eastern fashion, and living a life of scandalous adultery with Cleopatra. Octavian told anyone who would listen that the new Dionysus had lost touch with Roman values. Roman values that were, of course, exemplified by Octavian, the new Apollo. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 50, The Donations of Alexandria. Last week, we focused mainly on Octavian's trials in the West. So this week, I want to begin by tracing Antony's activities in the East before moving on to the final falling out between the two triumvir colleagues. Because after failing miserably to conquer Parthia, Antony's status in Rome will plummet, leaving him vulnerable to political broadsides by Octavian, who will launch an all-out propaganda blitz against him. Neither being shrinking violets when it came to the game of power politics, the war of words escalated quickly into simply war. As I said last week, 41 BC had opened with bad news for the triumvirate. While Octavian dealt with the revolt cooked up by Fulvia and Lucius Antony, Mark Antony was faced with a preemptive strike by the Parthian Empire against Syria. For the next 3 years, Antony's legions would be forced to engage in a running war with the charismatic, popular, and brilliant Parthian prince Pakur. Before the Romans were able to react, the Parthians had overrun Syria and Judea and placed puppets on the thrones of both kingdoms. Constantly distracted by internal Roman politics and the preparations for his larger offensive, Antony left the prosecution of these initial Parthian campaigns to lieutenants, specifically a capable general named Ventidius. In 38 BC, Ventidius was able to corner and kill Pakur in battle outside of Antioch. but he was curiously unwilling to follow up his victory and take an important Parthian stronghold on the Euphrates River. Word began to trickle back to Antony that Ventidius was accepting bribes to hold back his forces. So Antony relieved the general of command and headed out to take control of the situation himself. But with winter approaching and the city untaken, Antony prudently chose to withdraw the attack. Plutarch mentions that he took home with him some 300 Greek talents, a friendly gift from the Parthians that, of course, had nothing to do with him breaking off the siege. In 37 BC, though, Antony was ready to go on the attack. Not only had he settled affairs with Octavian and renewed the triumvirate, but he also reaffirmed his alliance with Queen Cleopatra. As with the last time Antony and Cleopatra had established friendly terms with one another, the most recent summit produced another child. With all the money he would ever need and 100,000 troops finally organized and ready for action, Antony decided it was high time he put his stamp on the East. In the beginning, things went splendidly. Basing himself out of Antioch, Antony swept through Syria and brought the territory back under Roman control. With this reclamation, it was time to do something about the unsatisfactory political arrangements that had governed the East since the days of Pompey the Great. Specifically, Antony was tired of the weak-willed and half-hearted client monarchies which left Rome without buffer states it could really trust. So Antony deposed all the kings from Pontus to Judea, installing Hellenized monarchs he could trust. Men, it should be noted, who were not just loyal to Antony in Rome, but were capable administrators in their own right. Indeed, after Antony's suicide in 30 BC, Octavian would survey the political systems his dead colleague had left behind and see no reason to disrupt any of it. In 36 BC, almost 20 years after Crassus had taken his shot at Parthia, and nearly a decade since Julius Caesar had begun planning his invasion, Mark Antony finally ordered 100,000 troops to march east. Rome was headed back into Parthia. The captured legionary standards of Crassus were still being held as trophies by the Parthian monarchy. Antony intended to get them back, by diplomacy if necessary, but hopefully by force. In the end, he never had the opportunity to use either. The invasion was a complete debacle. Antony's legions set out in June and followed the route through Armenia laid out by Julius Caesar and the route that should have been taken by Crassus. But once in Parthian territory, Antony was, like Crassus before him, at the mercy of local guides. But this time, rather than leading him into a trap, his double-crossing native guides simply fed information to the Parthians about the location of the slow-moving and underguarded Roman baggage train, emphasizing particularly the slow-moving and underguarded nature of it. In a blow that crippled the whole enterprise, the Parthian cavalry arrived out of nowhere and set fire to the line of carts, wagons, and most importantly, siege works. Having spent months moving slowly towards the inner fortresses of Parthia, Antony was now in a bind. His plan had been to capture at least one of the major cities before the end of summer so he could establish winter quarters. But now, with his siege engines gone, he had no hope of capturing anything. With winter bearing down, Antony realized the whole invasion was irretrievably bollocksed. He ordered his stupefied men to turn around and head back to the Mediterranean. The second great blow came when the Armenian king took the occasion of the smoldering baggage train to defect to the Parthians. Antony's only route home now lay through hostile territory. Winter set in across the hills and mountains of Armenia as Antony struggled to get his army home in one piece. While the Armenians prudently avoided outright attacking the Romans, they certainly didn't offer any aid or comfort to Antony's beleaguered army now dropping like flies in the harsh mountain snows. By the time they made it back to Antioch, 100,000 men who had left for Parthia were now 75,000. Antony had lost a quarter of his men and not even fought a single battle. He debated the pros and cons of suicide. While his colleague was licking his wounds over the winter of 36-35 BC, Octavian was riding high. Having defeated Sextus Pompey, his own stock had never been higher. But though he was no doubt already planning to eliminate Mark Antony from the picture, Octavian was content to let the older triumvir dig his own grave for a while. But until the time was ripe for a strike, Octavian had a problem. He couldn't afford to dismiss his legions. He would need them for the inevitable confrontation with Antony. But with Sextus gone, he had no real reason to keep them mobilized. So Octavian looked around for some trouble to get mixed up in and found the perfect excuse in Illyricum. "I can't disband the legions," he told the Senate. "I need them to fight those barbaric tribes in Illyricum, who have long thumbed their noses at Roman rule. Yes, Illyricum, that's the ticket. So rather than being told where the retirement plots were located, Octavian's soldiers got word that they were needed for the war in Illyricum. What war in Illyricum, they asked. The war you're about to start, they were told. Now get packed. Illyricum was a wild country of fiercely independent tribes located in what is today the Balkans. So beyond giving him an excuse to keep his armies intact, pacifying the region would be a real propaganda coup for Octavian, because Illyricum didn't just border the empire, it bordered Italy itself. Octavian spent the next 2 years off and on in the Balkans. He constructed a fleet to tackle the pirate havens off the east coast of the Adriatic, and himself led the infantry all over the countryside, forcing tribe after tribe to acknowledge Roman rule. He penetrated as far as the Danube River, which Octavian dreamed one day would be the stable border of the empire. In the course of one siege, he even displayed some of the personal courage that had always been conspicuously absent from his career. While his men hesitated on a gangplank leading over a wall, Octavian and a few bodyguards rushed headlong across the short bridge. The episode mirrored a famous episode from the career of Alexander the Great, leading commentators, even at the time, to suspect that the entire scene was a publicity stunt engineered to dispose once and for all of the persistent rumors of cowardice. But whether intended or not, when reports of the incident made their way back to Rome, Octavian found his reputation greatly enhanced. In 34 BC, while Octavian was entering his second year in Illyricum, Antony was ready to make amends for the shame of his disastrous invasion. He had spent the year and a half that had passed since returning from Parthia, living with Cleopatra in Alexandria. The fact that he was still married to Octavia does not seem to have entered his head at all. Though she had always been a loyal wife, the bond between Antony and Cleopatra had grown far beyond a mere political alliance. Octavian privately, and pretty soon publicly, fumed at Antony's blatantly disrespectful treatment of his sister. What did it say about him that he would ignore a fine Roman woman in favor of some Eastern temptress? But regardless of what the chattering classes thought about it, Antony was perfectly content with his life in Egypt. Some said he had no intention of coming back to Rome at all. And really, why would he? He was passing his days in splendid luxury, ruling over half the known world. Alexandria was a rich, cosmopolitan, and rationally laid-out city. In contrast to hot, crowded, noisy, and messy Rome, there was really no comparison. Arriving in the Egyptian capital after defeating Antony and Cleopatra, Octavian himself would be smitten with the well-thought-out metropolis he found. But rather than dream of moving to Egypt, Octavian dreamed of reinventing Rome. For the duration of his rule over the empire, Octavian, later Augustus, would spend enormous amounts of time, energy, and treasure trying to remake Rome in Alexandria's image, to turn the city of brick into a city of marble. But while Antony slowly went native in Egypt, his sense of Roman honor had not deserted him. The betrayal of the Armenian king had not been forgotten, and as soon as the spring of 34 BC rolled around, Antony set out to remove the offending monarch. Flashing some of the old brilliance, he made short work of the Armenian army and deposed the traitor king without too much difficulty. The victory in Armenia, however, would finally expose the growing distance between Mark Antony and the Roman people. Rather than finding some random, capable noble to reign as the new king of Armenia, Antony placed his own son Alexander on the throne. An even greater affront than the simple dynastic implications of the appointment was that Alexander was Antony's son with Cleopatra, not Octavia. And it only got worse after that. When he returned home to Alexandria, he staged a triumph to celebrate the victory. Never in history had a triumph taken place outside of Rome itself, and Roman opinion was scandalized. And as if the triumph itself wasn't bad enough, at the culmination of the event, Antony read aloud a proclamation that has since become known as the Donations of Alexandria. Just as he had awarded control of Armenia to Alexander, he announced his intention to give Cyrenaica and Libya to Alexander's twin sister Selene, and granted his youngest son Syria and Cilicia. He declared Cleopatra to be the Queen of Kings, and in the most provocative move of all, named Caesarion, Julius Caesar's son by Cleopatra, King of Egypt, King of Kings, and crucially, the true heir of his father. When Octavian and the Senate heard about this series of proclamations, they erupted in outrage. Antony had gone off the reservation and was now putting his illegitimate children in control of Roman provinces. He was, in short, turning the Eastern Empire into his personal kingdom. Octavian, though, as much as he railed against Antony in public for his monarchical ambitions, was not nearly so concerned about what child technically ruled what province and who was inheriting what. What troubled him was the massive navy Antony was constructing. All the military spending Antony had been undertaking of late was ostensibly for his planned reinvasion of Parthia, but you have to wonder, who needs 400 ships to invade the Iranian plateau? And of course, when you got all the way to the inner circle, the threat of Caesarion was acutely felt. Octavian's whole career was predicated on being the heir of Julius Caesar. True, in recent years, he had established himself as his own man, but still, people were following Gaius Julius Caesar for a reason. If the claim of Caesarion's legitimacy began to gain traction, it could threaten the whole project. Now, in Octavian's inner circle was, of course, Agrippa. But there was also another man of equal importance who I have thus far inexcusably neglected. Gaius Maecenas was about 7 years older than Octavian and Agrippa, but he had fallen in with the two ambitious youths early on. He had been with Octavian in Apollonia when news of Julius Caesar's assassination came, and he had been a powerful force behind the scenes throughout Octavian's rise to power. Just as Agrippa was Octavian's chief military advisor, Maecenas was his chief political advisor. He had been the guiding force behind Octavian's first marriage to Scribonia, as well as arranging the treaties of Brundisium and Tarentum that had avoided potential civil war with Antony. While Agrippa and Octavian were off fighting battles, it was Maecenas who was left behind to oversee things in Rome, much like Antony had been left in charge of the capital during the campaigns of Julius Caesar. Much like Antony, too, Maecenas had a penchant for extravagant, indulgent living. But where Antony embraced violent extremes, Maecenas was actually a moderating influence on some of Octavian's more bloodthirsty tendencies. His love of soft living and the arts, though, were unmatched, which led to a tense relationship with the stolid, battle-hardened, and humorless Agrippa. In the end, the two were held together only by their mutual loyalty to Octavian, but both proved to be indispensable to their master's success. Agrippa's role was obvious. He won the great battles that put Octavian in power. But, for example, it was Maecenas' patronage of the arts that was the key to the cult of personality that would surround Caesar Augustus and keep him in power. Maecenas cultivated the leading artists and poets of the day, specifically Horace and Virgil, and engaged them in a great project to perpetually glorify his boss. In the words of Anthony Everett, Maecenas somehow managed to keep them all on message without resorting to the heavy hand of censorship, which is, I can assure you, no mean feat when dealing with independent creative types. In our discussions of the reign of Augustus, we will have much more to say about both Maecenas and Agrippa, who will play as much a role in the imperial administration as they had played in establishing it. At least from the time the donations of Alexandria were announced, the three old friends were actively plotting war with Antony. The trick was to bait him into making the first move so Octavian would not look like the aggressor. Octavian slated himself to hold the consulship for 33 BC, and from that position, he planned to do everything in his power to turn Rome against Antony. On the first day he presided over the Senate, Octavian let loose with the most inflammatory attacks he could think of. Antony was living in sin with Cleopatra in the East. Antony had betrayed the honor of blameless Octavia. Antony had illegally executed Sextus Pompey without trial. Antony started wars with foreign powers without the consent of the Senate. Antony was making himself a king. In short, Antony was the enemy of all that was good, pure, and decent about Rome. For the rest of the year, Octavian and Antony were engaged in a war of words for the hearts and minds of Romans everywhere. Antony sent letters back to the Senate that were read aloud by his supporters, claiming that Octavian had forged the adoption papers of Julius Caesar, that he was consumed with a megalomaniacal lust for power, that he was a low-born provincial who had lied, cheated, and stolen his way up the political ladder. It was also whispered that Octavian had engaged in unnatural relations with his uncle on his way back from Spain in order to win Caesar's favor. When 32 BC came around and Octavian's turn in the consulship ended, the propaganda war had played out to a near stalemate. But in provoking the confrontations, Octavian had succeeded in at least one important respect. With the triumvirate expiring December 31, 33 BC, there was no chance now that it would be renewed. The 10-year-old partnership was officially dissolved. Now the facade of collegial alliance could be dropped. They were rivals and enemies, It was time for everyone to come right out and say it. Octavian even used the occasion of the triumvirate's expiration to hit Antony with a solid body blow. He made sure he was out in front, declaring that he would no longer be addressed as triumvir, as he had been for the last decade. That was all in the past. The preeminence of the consuls and the Senate had returned to Rome for good. When Antony, though, refused to give up the title he had grown accustomed to, Octavian pounced, arguing that Antony had no legal standing, no right to the title, and technically no official role in the state whatsoever. If he continued to wield executive power in the East, he was doing so illegally and usurping the power of the Senate and the consuls. He saved his best for Cleopatra, who he built up as some sort of evil sorceress who had hypnotized Antony and controlled him like a puppet. It was important that Octavian lay as much at the feet of Cleopatra as he could. He was hoping to induce the Senate into declaring war, and he knew that they would find it far easier to direct their ire at an evil foreign queen than at Mark Antony himself, who had spent his entire adult life in the service of Rome. Unfortunately for Octavian, many in the Senate weren't having these over-the-top accusations and were not ready to abandon Antony just yet. And in fact, by a stroke of luck, the two consuls for the year 32 BC also happened to be Antony loyalists. They denounced Octavian for his slander and introduced a resolution to censure young Caesar. Unwilling to accept the rebuke, Octavian was forced to reveal what everybody already knew, that despite having given up his triumvir title, he was not giving up on power. He unilaterally and illegally called a meeting of the Senate and addressed the charges brought against him, conspicuously flanked by armed bodyguards. This proved to be a fatal breach of protocol. In protest, fully one-third of the Senate packed their bags and left Rome, headed for Alexandria. Included in their ranks were the two consuls, who took with them all the official executive authority of the state. Octavian, who had for years been claiming his subservience to the Constitution, was now forced to reveal his true colors. He didn't give a whit about the Constitution. He had no official position within the state, but there was no doubt about it. Octavian ruled Rome. Later in the year, he received a gift from the East. A high-ranking defector from Alexandria brought with him the pretext that Octavian could use to finally induce a declaration of war on Antony. It seems that Antony had recently lodged a will in the Temple of the Vestas, the contents of which, if known, would finally reveal the depths of his abandonment of Rome. Octavian demanded that the Vestal Virgins produce the document, but citing sacred oaths, they refused. Undeterred, Octavian simply stormed the temple and seized the will. Romans everywhere were shocked by this unthinkable violence against the temple, but when Octavian began reading passages of the document aloud, they soon forgot all about Octavian's sacrilege. Antony had left large portions of his estate to his illegitimate children, reaffirmed the claim that Caesarion was the true heir of Julius Caesar, which was, it should be noted, an impossibility within Roman law, as Cleopatra was not a citizen. But most shocking of all, he requested to be buried in Alexandria rather than Rome. Octavian argued that Antony had betrayed his Roman heritage and that it was high time for the Senate to recognize that he was an enemy of the state. Moved by the revelations contained in the will, the Senate, well, two-thirds of the Senate anyway, declared war on Egypt. The moment of truth had come. Octavian and Antony were finally going to face off in battle. The prize? Sole control of the Roman Empire. Antony knew what was coming down the pike as soon as a third of the Senate showed up on his doorstep. The 400 ships he'd built for, the invasion of Parthia were soon sailing for Greece. In a crucial development, Antony decided not to lead the fleet all by himself, but appointed Cleopatra as co-general. There's no straight answer for why he chose to elevate Cleopatra to this high rank in the army, but the effect was almost wholly negative. The Romans who had fled Italy to join with Antony now found themselves subservient to a woman and a foreigner, a situation they found intolerable. This is in no way meant to knock the capabilities of Cleopatra or get bogged down in comments on Roman misogyny, but it's simply to point out that the queen's position did prove to be a corrosive acid eating slowly at the heart of morale in the Antonian camp. But Antony had ignored advice to leave her behind, or better yet, kill her and annex Egypt. And the two set sail for Greece, ready for the showdown with Octavian. By the winter of 32-31 BC, the bulk of the Antonian fleet settled into the Ambracian Gulf on the coast of the Ionian Sea. It was a curious choice of positions. When it came to strategically locating armies for east-west showdowns, the common assumption was that the ports along the Adriatic were far more valuable. By stowing his fleet far to the south, Antony essentially ceded Octavian an opportunity to ferry ground forces from Brundisium over to Dyrrhachium. Historians have postulated that Antony was as concerned as Octavian about looking like an aggressor and wanted to clearly signal that his intention was not to invade Italy, so he chose not to plant a huge navy off the coast of the peninsula. He may also have been concerned about keeping his supply lines from and escape route back to Egypt open. Whatever the final calculus that led to the decision was, the upshot was that with his fleet in the Ambracian Gulf, when it came time to sail out in the spring, he would have to pass the small port town of Actium, which stood at the head of the narrow entrance to the Gulf. Prior to their falling out, Octavian and Antony had been slated to share a year in the consulship in 31 BC. With Antony persona non grata in Octavian's Rome, young Caesar took his position as senior executive without Antony in the way. Octavian began to claim, not totally inaccurately, that traitorous Mark Antony was leading a foreign army against the legitimate government of Rome. It was true that Antony served no official capacity and that his legions were led and recruited largely from the east, while Octavian, as the rightful consul, was leading armies drawn from Italy itself. But at this point, everyone knew what the score was. No one bought the hype that one side was fighting for Rome and the other side against Rome, or for the Constitution or against the Constitution. This was just two powerful men using the resources of the empire to decide once and for all which one of them would run the whole show. Octavian and Agrippa decided that their best shot against Antony, who, despite all their propaganda and slanders, they never once underestimated as a military commander, was to act boldly. Antony had set up a critical supply hub at Methone in the southwest Peloponnese. If the city could be taken, Antony would find himself without access to fresh supplies and susceptible to a maritime siege of Actium. So in March of 31 BC, before the winter was out, Agrippa led a daring run through the storming waters of the Ionian and launched a surprise assault on the city, capturing it before Antony could react. When the spring arrived, Octavian hastily ferried 50,000 ground forces across the Adriatic and marched them south. Suddenly, Antony was trapped. Octavian's forces prevented him from marching his army overland out of the Ambracian Gulf, while Agrippa's navy positioned itself off the coast and dared him to try to sail out of danger. Antony recognized immediately what a disastrous position he was in. Just as with the failed Parthian expedition, he knew that his only hope was retreat. He had to get back to Egypt and regroup, or all would be lost. And he had to do it fast, too. His men were badly undersupplied, and, trapped in confined quarters during the summer heat, were falling prey to disease, the great scourge of armies. To top things off, reports came daily listing off which high-ranking officials had slipped across the lines during the night. His allies and his gods were deserting him. Next week, Antony will make a break for it. Though at the time the Battle of Actium was an important but not necessarily decisive victory for Octavian, history would soon be written by the victors to portray it as the great and final triumph of Octavian over the enemies of Rome. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 51, Actium. After the partnership between Antony and Octavian broke down following the dissolution of the Second Triumvirate in 32 BC, there was no longer room in the empire for both men. Everyone had long suspected that war would break out between the two triumvirs eventually. Now, that war had arrived. Once again, Romans were forced to choose sides in a civil war. I honestly feel sorry for the exhausted generations of this final century of the Republic. These men and women who were born just before Sulla's first march on Rome in 88 BC, who grew up in the vicious proscription regimes of the two feuding generals, Sulla and Marius, came of age at the time of the Catiline conspiracy, and then grew into full adulthood with Julius Caesar's civil wars raging all around them. As they moved into their 50s and 60s, ready to take on the role of elder statesmen or presiding matrons, they were caught up in the triumvirs' wars against Brutus and Cassius and then Sextus Pompey. And now, Octavian and Antony were drawing yet another bloody line in the sand. Every step of the way, these poor souls had been forced to choose sides. Choosing the right side usually meant little more than the opportunity to sacrifice something valuable to the victor, be it land or treasure, while choosing the wrong side usually meant exile and death. While it was true that many were staunch partisans of one side or another, most were just average men and women trying to live their lives, for whom these conflicts were never black and white. On this side was their son, on that side their brother. Their father had been killed by this man, but their daughter's life was now inextricably linked to his success. It was never easy. Every choice, every year, came with more heartache and suffering. The history of their nation was riddled with tales of patriotic solidarity in the face of a barbarian invasion or a long war against the Samnites or Carthaginians. But to this generation, it all must have seemed like some sort of cruel fantasy. Romans did not come together to help one another out in times of trouble. No, that was when they turned on each other and tried to squeeze partisan advantage out of the situation. Edward Gibbon famously said that being a citizen of Rome in the 2nd century AD was perhaps the greatest time and place to live in all of human history. No such luck for these poor sods, stuck in the last century BC. For them, it was all war, upheaval, and trying to figure out the least bad path through a dangerous and unpredictable time. But the hardship endured by the millions of citizens who were just trying to get along counted for little in the personal struggle between Octavian and Antony, who saw only each other. In late 32 BC, Antony and his recently announced co-general, Cleopatra, had sailed with their fleet for the Ambracian Gulf, intent on forcing Octavian out of the picture once and for all. But Octavian, who had provoked Antony into action, had no intention of going down easily. Antony and Cleopatra were an abomination, little more than Eastern monarchs who were no more Roman than Pyrrhus or Antiochus or Mithridates. Also, they stood in the way of the one ambition he had pursued with single-minded purpose for the last decade, sole mastery of the Roman Empire. Beyond the small port town of Actium, the two rivals were about to meet for what would prove in retrospect to be their final showdown. When the spring of 31 BC rolled around, Antony recognized that he was boxed in at the Ambracian Gulf. Before I go any further, I would like to tell everyone that in A History of Rome First, I've actually got maps to go along with this episode. So, if you go to thehistoryofrome.typepad.com, you can download them and follow along visually. If you are driving while listening to this, however, you are not allowed to look at the maps. Safety first. My intention is to try to slowly go back and add maps to the back episodes, and then keep them coming when necessary for future episodes. So enjoy them. I spent a lot of time drawing little tiny triangles, and I hope you find the maps helpful. That said, where was I? Ah, yes. Antony had stowed his fleet in the Ambracian Gulf and had inadvertently allowed Octavian to park a ground force north of his position, while Agrippa simultaneously blockaded the narrow strait leading out of the Gulf. See it there on the map? Sweet. At first, Octavian sought a quick battle. He deployed his fleet and dared Antony to come out and fight. But short on the manpower he needed to both man the oars of his ships and fight at the same time, Antony declined the invitation. So Octavian settled into siege mode. The Caesarian forces had access to supplies and fresh water, while Antony was cut off from his supply bases in Egypt after Agrippa had captured Methone the month before. Spring gave way to summer, and with the summer came heat, exhaustion, and disease. Dysentery and malaria swept through the Antonian camp, killing scores of men daily. Now it was Antony who decided to offer battle, before he lost all his men to plagues. He hopped over the narrow strait and set up a forward camp just south of Octavian, and from there tried to pick a ground fight. He sent his infantry the long way around the Ambracian Gulf to make a play at capturing Octavian's water source, but the attempt was repulsed. In the midst of the battle, one of the eastern client kings providing needed auxiliaries to Antony deserted. It was a sign of things to come. Over the course of the next few months, Antony's Roman allies would begin taking any opportunity they could to slip over to Octavian's camp, while foreign allies simply took opportunities to head home. By August, things in the Antonian camp had gone from bad to worse. Antony was no longer losing peripheral senators to defection. Now he was losing key members of his senior staff, many of whom cited the presence of Cleopatra in the camp issuing orders as an inexcusable affront. Mostly, though, they just saw the handwriting on the wall and wanted to get out while the getting was good. In mid-August, Antony tried to break out. He sent what warships he could staff out of the strait on a particularly foggy day and tried to surprise Octavian's blockade into scattering long enough to make escape possible for the rest of the fleet. But the attempt failed when Agrippa coincidentally arrived with reinforcements just as the attack was about to get underway. Antony's ships were pushed back. Finally, at the end of August, Antony withdrew back to his original camp and made plans for a head-on collision with Octavian. A ground escape was deemed too risky. Not only would he have to fight his way through Octavian's infantry, but even if he succeeded, he would be faced with a months-long march around the Mediterranean back to Egypt. If, on the other hand, he loaded as much as he could onto as many ships as he could find oarsmen for, there was a real chance that he, Cleopatra, and most importantly, their floating war chest, could make it back to Alexandria and the 14 legions still mobilized there. It was a terribly risky plan, especially after it became apparent that he would be sending just 230 ships against the more than 400 under the command of Agrippa, but there was no choice. He set fire to the ships he could not man so they didn't fall into Octavian's hands. The clouds of smoke were the signal to everyone that a battle was about to begin. On the morning of September 2nd, 31 BC, Antony slowly led his flotilla out of the gulf, through the narrow strait, and out into open waters. Agrippa and Octavian were waiting for him, with Agrippa, prudently ceded overall command of the battle, manning the left flank, and Octavian on the right. Antony hoped to draw his enemies into the confined quarters just beyond the entrance to the gulf, so their numerical superiority would be muted. But Agrippa had already decided this was a likely tactic, and declined to move in. The morning passed with the two fleets bobbing in the water, waiting for someone to make a move. Finally, Antony was forced to acknowledge that Agrippa wasn't taking the bait. He ordered his ships forward, and the Battle of Actium began. On the Caesarian left, Agrippa worked the ships under his command around so that they swung over and came at Antony from the north. To counter, Antony shifted his own line so that what had begun as a north-south line was now an east-west line. This all had the effect of leaving the center of the Caesarian line open. With Octavian fully engaged in the southern theater and unable to close the gap left open by Agrippa's enveloping move, Cleopatra saw her opportunity. She had been held back from the main line with 60 ships and had thus far taken no part in the actual battle. This was by design, as her flagship was the key to the whole escape, because on it was the Antonian treasury. Even if every ship but hers was captured, there was still hope. With the afternoon winds blowing out to sea and the middle of the battle open, Cleopatra hoisted her sails and fled the scene. Seeing the queen lighting out, Antony quickly transferred himself off of his lumbering flagship onto a quicker vessel and followed her. He could only hope that the rest of his fleet would disengage and follow. If they couldn't, at least they had bought their general and his fortune time to get away. For the most part, they couldn't get away. Outnumbered and hemmed in, the ships that weren't sunk were forced to retreat back into the gulf. After an evening spent out at sea making sure no one slipped away, Octavian surveyed the scene when dawn finally arrived the next morning. Cleopatra had obviously gotten away, but he had no idea what had become of Antony. 40 or so of the Antonian ships had been sunk, and the 130 left were now cowering in the gulf. All in all, it was a clear victory. Mitigated by the escape of Cleopatra, obviously, but Octavian had succeeded in dealing Antony, wherever he was, a fairly crippling blow. The next week was spent mopping up after the battle. The 130 trapped ships surrendered without much convincing, but there was still a sizable Antonian infantry in the area that needed to be defanged. Unable to fit everyone onto the 230 ships, Antony had left some 50,000 men under the command of the intensely loyal Publius Canidius Crassus on shore. Crassus had orders to march them back to Macedonia in the event that Antony was able to make good his escape, and from there attempt the overland march to Egypt. But the soldiers had other ideas. At first, they waited for Antony to reappear, not understanding that the whole point had been for him to get out of Dodge, not fight a battle to decide the war right then and there. When it became clear that Antony was dead or had fled, the attitudes of the troops changed dramatically. Over the head, or I guess maybe under the head, of Crassus The soldiers offered to surrender to Octavian if they were treated as if they had been on the winning side the whole time. Octavian jumped at the chance to nullify the sizable threat they posed and maybe demonstrate some of the famous clemency that had won his uncle so much acclaim. He was fast coming to the realization that maybe power was finally in his grasp. He needed to start thinking like a statesman if he was going to be the master of all Romans. He accepted the terms and agreed to demobilize the legions with all the honors and spoils that were due his own men. Disgusted, Crassus and a few senior officers packed their bags and slipped away back to Alexandria, where they hoped to find plans to reverse the setback at Actium well in the works. Octavian himself was in no great hurry to chase after Antony, who, it was now known, had made his way out of the battle and followed Cleopatra back to Egypt. He settled in for the winter on the island of Samos in the eastern Aegean and made preparations for the invasion of Egypt he would undertake when spring arrived. Meanwhile, he sent home thousands of Italian veterans who had completed their service time. Unfortunately, though, the spoils and land they had dreamed would be theirs when they got home were nowhere to be found. Once again, the bank had been broken. The veterans began to agitate violently against this injustice, and Agrippa was sent back to pacify them. But even the great general, who had the respect and admiration of all the mutinous ex-soldiers, could do nothing to settle them down. Octavian was forced to return to Italy himself to deal with the situation. When he arrived in Brundisium, it seemed like the entire population of Rome was there to greet him. In a sign of the times, rather than greeting the returning Octavian at the gates of Rome, as would have been the custom, the entire Senate traveled down to the southern port to greet him as his ship docked. It was clear who Rome thought would be their eventual master. Octavian issued IOUs to his angry troops. It was all he could do, and promised to settle everything when Antony was disposed of for good. They accepted his word. There was really nothing else they could do. But not everyone in Rome was so quick to embrace Octavian. The young Marcus Lepidus, son of the former triumvir, decided to hatch this decade's liberator plot. He began the process of acquiring support, just as Brutus and Cassius had done, and started making plans to assassinate Octavian as soon as he came back to Rome. But Maecenas, left once again in control of the city, caught wind of the plot, and swiftly extracted the names of everyone involved. There would be no repeat of the Ides of March on his watch. Lepidus, and anyone foolish enough to join him, were executed without delay. Confident that things in Italy were well in hand, the spring of 30 BC arrived, with Octavian focused on Egypt. Envoys of all kinds, some from Antony, some from Cleopatra, some from independent factions within Alexandria, had been seeking him out all winter to try to avert the invasion. But Octavian had made up his mind. He didn't want to just destroy Antony and Cleopatra. He wanted to seize Egypt and hold it for himself. No negotiations, no bribes, no settlements. Straight up annexation and under his personal control. The only way to make sure that happened was to take the country by force. Over the winter, things between Antony and Cleopatra had deteriorated. They still had money and troops, but they were trapped in Egypt without any hope of escape or further aid from any of the client kingdoms of the East, all of whom were now under Octavian's influence. Antony refused to bow to the inevitable and continued making plans for the defense of Alexandria, but it was clear that Cleopatra began to pull away from him, perhaps thinking about life past Antony. If she was thinking she could perhaps latch on to Octavian the way she had latched on first to Julius Caesar and then Mark Antony, she was deluding herself. But the survival instinct is strong, and cornered like rats, both Antony and Cleopatra entertained pleasant fantasies where they somehow made it out of this alive and in power. But as we know, they did not make it out alive or in power. When the spring came, the first piece of bad news arrived. 4 legions stationed west of Alexandria had defected and were now marching towards the city on Octavian's orders. Octavian, meanwhile, was leading his own forces through Syria and would soon be coming at Egypt from the east. If there was one thing Octavian truly loved, it was a pincer move, and the invasion of Egypt was just another fine example of it. Antony made his way out to the defected legions and tried to win them back to his side, but they forced him to retreat empty-handed. Octavian encountered little resistance from the Egyptian troops who were supposed to be guarding the frontier and was soon knocking at Alexandria's door. Realizing that everything was falling apart around him and that this was likely the end, Antony planned one last great battle that, win or lose, he did not plan to return from. But even his attempt to die gloriously was a disaster. On August the 1st, he sent out the Egyptian navy to meet Octavian's fleet, which had been pacing their commander's advance. Antony himself stood at the head of a combined army of infantry and cavalry on land. When the navy engaged Octavian's fleet, Antony was going to launch a ground assault. But as soon as the ships were within earshot of one another, Antony's maritime forces announced their total surrender. Seeing the ships raise the white flag, Antony's cavalry deserted, followed quickly by scores of infantry. Soon, his entire army was running for their lives, leaving Antony, who had spent all this time planning a fine soldier's death, alone on the battlefield and humiliated. He marched back to the palace in a rage and demanded to see Cleopatra, who he suspected of engineering the surrenders and desertions. Cleopatra, afraid of what the furious and probably suicidal Antony was going to do to her, sent an attendant to tell him that she was already dead. For Antony, this was the final breaking point. He returned to his room, stabbed himself in the stomach, and died. But not quite yet. The self-inflicted wound, though incredibly painful, was not immediately fatal. As he lay in agony dying, Cleopatra heard what he had done and decided to send for him. I'm not really sure this was the nicest thing in the world to do, seeing as how his suicide had been precipitated by the belief that she was already dead, but regardless, attendants dragged the dying Antony to Cleopatra's hiding place, a half-built mausoleum she had been constructing for herself over the years. When she saw Antony, she began to wail. Antony tried unsuccessfully to comfort her, and then, according to legend, called for one last cup of wine to drink before dying. The final goblet of Dionysian elixir quaffed, Antony died. Though posterity tends to record Actium as the final climax in the drama of the Second Triumvirate, it was not really until Octavian captured Egypt that the deal was really sealed. Rome and the Western Empire were already under his command, but now his only real rival for power was dead, and he controlled the richest kingdom in the East. Now, his star was not just ascendant, it had ascended. He stood atop the Roman Empire, alone and unchallenged. He relished his victory, and touring the magnificent city of Alexandria, began to plan for the future. Power won is only meaningful if it is put to productive use. Unlike the Dionysian Antony, the Apollonian Octavian was not aiming for power so he could live a life of decadent leisure. He was aiming for power so he could remake the Roman world. And remake it, he would. There were still loose ends to clear up, of course. Cleopatra was still holed up in her mausoleum hiding place, which would now become a de facto prison. Octavian used familiar go-betweens to coax the queen out of her hole, and when she finally presented herself, the toll of the last year was evident. No longer the splendid, bejeweled Eastern queen who had seduced the most powerful men in Rome. She was now unadorned, haggard, and pathetic. When she met Octavian, she at first tried to deny that she had played any meaningful role in Antony's career, and that it had been him, all him. "I am just a woman," she argued. "What influence could a woman have over a strong Roman man?" Octavian practically choked when he heard her revise history on the fly. But when it was clear that Octavian wasn't buying the whole "I am an innocent bystander" routine, Cleopatra switched and simply began begging for her life. This, Octavian thought, is more like it. According to the official records, Octavian did indeed decide to spare the queen's life, but mostly so that he could parade her through Rome in the triumph he planned to celebrate as soon as he got home. But to Cleopatra, this stay of execution turned out to be even more intolerable than death itself. She had hoped to somehow finagle Octavian into letting her live in Egypt and remain a client monarch, loyal once again to the House of Caesar. It was fast becoming apparent, though, that her future held nothing but embarrassment, humiliation, and probably obscure imprisonment in some far corner of the empire. To an Egyptian pharaohess, accustomed to being at the center of politics, religion, and war, the fate Octavian had cooked up for her was literally a fate worse than death. According to the familiar legend, she had an attendant smuggle an asp into her room by concealing the snake in a basket of figs. Cleopatra then poked at the snake until it lashed out, sank its poisonous fangs into her, and killed her. No one really knows how true the story actually is, but it has gained widespread acceptance anyway. However it happened, Cleopatra died, and it was likely, though not proven conclusively to be, a suicide. Octavian took his time enjoying the sights in Alexandria. Of particular interest was the city's most famous relic, and he ordered the priests to open the sarcophagus and display the mummified remains of Alexander the Great. The Macedonian general had long been the benchmark by which all future politicians and generals judged themselves. He had attained the throne at just 19 and then conquered his way to India before his 30th birthday. The career of Alexander, as meteoric an arc as can be imagined, is typically a universal humbler of great men. Even a 39-year-old Julius Caesar had famously despaired at a shrine to the great general, lamenting the fact that he had done nothing with his life. But I have to think that 33-year-old Octavian, viewing the mummified remains of 33-year-old Alexander, had to believe that he stacked up pretty well in comparison, probably one of the few times in all of history that that can actually be said. Meditating on the career of Alexander is supposed to force you to realize that you'll never be the greatest man in the history of the world, no matter how hard you try. Because no matter what, Alexander will always have done more than you, faster than you, better than you. But Octavian, I don't think that was Octavian's takeaway at all. He was now the sole ruler of the Mediterranean, heading an empire that was richer and more stable than anything Alexander had put together. And he was, like I said, still only 33 years old. Rather than walking away from the shrine to Alexander humbled, I think Octavian probably walked away feeling pretty good about himself. The transformation from mere Octavian to the divine Augustus was no doubt well underway. Next week, Octavian will return to Rome to formally undergo that transformation into Augustus. It was time for the ruthless, power-hungry young Caesar to become the absolute ruler of the Roman Empire. It would not be a quick transition or a simple one. Everything continued to be couched in the language of the Republic, and it was only over the course of years and then decades that the semantic facade began to wear off, and it was revealed who was really in control and who had really been in control the whole time. There is no clear line to draw to say that this is where the Republic ends and this is where the Imperium begins, especially because no one in the Julio-Claudian dynasty, who would rule Rome for the next 100 years, was ever willing to come out and admit publicly what had happened. But make no mistake, the Republic was now dead. And along with all his improvements and reforms and great works on behalf of the empire, Augustus Caesar pursued policy to make sure that it stayed dead.